Okay, we're ready to go. This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with conservation specialists relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Dr. William Mumaw, Emeritus Professor of International Environmental Policy and Founding Director of the Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at the Fletcher School. He received a PhD in physical chemistry from MIT and had a 26-year career in chemistry and environmental studies at Williams College, and more recently at Tufts College. Since 1989, is now an emeritus professor and still teaches. He's been a lead author of 5 reports to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The IPCC shared the Nobel Prize for its climate work in 2007. Currently, he works on natural solutions to climate change, with a focus on increasing carbon dioxide removal and sequestration by forests, wetlands, and soils. He's co-author of a recent paper declaring a climate emergency that has been endorsed by over 11,000 scientists. Well, welcome, Dr. Mumaw. It's a pleasure to talk to you today, and we want to talk about climate change, so welcome.
Thank you very much.
What the urgent challenges that we face regarding the climate?
Well, I think just about everybody by now has noticed that the climate is not what it used to be,
right?
And that it's changing very rapidly. The respiration of soil bacteria and plants, which means that they are exhaling more carbon dioxide than they used to, and so we're actually triple what scientists call feedback loop, where we warm it up and nature doubles up. it increases it even more.
So is there a way that we can mitigate and adapt to climate change?
Well, those are two different yet related strategies. I mean, the climate is changing, and we are adapting. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which we do things differently than we used to. Coastal regions is that the seas are rising because warm water expands, and then we are also what you are experiencing is we're melting all the glaciers in the world. What happens is that when we have these increased intense storms, that raises the sea level even higher for these storm surges. Sunny day flooding, one out of every 4 days.
Mm.
Well, that means you're getting your feet wet,
right?
You know, twice a week.
Water seeks its full level. So I wondered about you mentioned that some places are affected by higher sea levels more than others. So I don't understand that difference.
Well, there are a couple of things that are happening. One is there are some places in the world where it makes it a larger sea level rise from the point of view of someone standing on land. In other places where glaciers retreated some time ago, the land is still rebounding. The water will be distributed along the east coast of the United States and Canada. That the rise will be there. Will be there.
That's pressure from the ice keeping it down.
That's right. Yes. Well, the ice is just is basically it's keeping the land there down, but it's also it's just the gravitational pull of the ice is keeping the ocean. So it's higher there than it would otherwise be.
Your website states that you have 3 goals. Would you enumerate those? Climate, life on land, and life in water.
Yeah, well, the situation that we have is we're changing, I guess I should add one more, that as carbon dioxide dissolves in it, it's becoming less alkaline and more acidic. And that's leading to the loss of everything from coral reefs to any creature that fires. You may have noticed that another thing that's happening in the West is that the fire regime lasts longer, the droughts last longer. While the West has been baking in the last all through August, we in the East have been they're hard to imagine if you haven't experienced them. And Death Valley hit 130 one day recently. And what's happening is the best explanation for that is that we have disrupted the jet stream. And as you know, cold air sinks and warm air rises. And so there are these circulation patterns where the cold air kind of slides down the face of the earth, but the earth is turning. And that generates what looks like the jet stream. It looks, in other words, we get this jet stream which dips down, and as the temperature changes, it moves and comes back up again. Arctic air can come all the way down, even as far as Texas, as we've seen these ice storms and things there. But it also has gotten to rotate around the Earth rather slowly, but they rotate. But the jet stream is weakened, and therefore it doesn't move like that. It just stays unperturbed, and if it's in your area where it's been looping downward, where we are, we're going to get cooler air. And so that's what's been happening this summer. The reason that is difference is happening is because we've, as you know, the Arctic ice is much less cover than it used to be. So the Arctic Ocean, instead of being covered with white ice reflecting sunlight, it is dark ocean. More of it is dark ocean. And that means that it's absorbing a lot of heat from the sun. Well, the atmosphere is next to the low frequency. So basically, the difference in temperature of the air above the Arctic is not as much colder as it used to be. And so you don't get that much more dense air flowing down, causing the jet stream. So we have really transformed our entire transformation it has had with the composition and structure of the atmosphere.
So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says the situation is dire and direct, and that there's a need for rapid, far-reaching, unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. What does that mean?
That's a mouthful, and it's scary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What it basically means is that, and we pointed this out in our climate emergency paper, that the changes that we're making are potentially leading carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stays for centuries that we put in today. The sooner we can halt the rise and begin to reverse it, we can talk later about how we would do that, the safer the planet is for us and for.
So how far advanced are the needed technologies for stemming this problem?
Well, there are two things we can do. One is one things we have to do is to reduce our emissions of heat trapping gases, and the main one of the carbon building block that contains the carbon is the building block of all living green plants. And so green plants are absorbing it and biomass into trees, it's wood in softer plants, it's the cellulose tissue. The good news is this could be a whole lot worse. We put about 10 or 11 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide every year, and yet more than half, about 55% of what we put in every year. Well, it doesn't absorb it directly. It's taking out that amount from the atmosphere. So there's this big store of it in the atmosphere. We've been adding to it since the Industrial Revolution, maybe even a little bit before from the Agricultural Revolution. And
curious, how do the oceans absorb CO2?
Just from the fact that there is, well, there's always, well, if things weren't changing, there would be an equilibrium between the amount in the ocean and this dissolved carbon dioxide in the atmosphere above the ocean. The ocean will absorb some of it. Now, it depends on the temperature and the salinity, but primarily the temperature. And so if the ocean gets warmer, it will absorb less. I mean, if you think about a warm soda can, if you pop the top on it, the whole thing just fizzes out when you release the pressure. So there is a small amount of pressure from what's in the atmosphere that gets absorbed by the ocean. And then plants, of course, in the ocean absorb carbon dioxide or take in carbon dioxide and convert it into cellulose.
Dealing with the forests and understanding how they absorb CO2. So how do tropical forests compare to temperate and boreal forests?
Well, all forests absorb carbon, carbon dioxide, really, and take the carbon and convert it into woody fiber. And then as leaves fall off and decay, they also contain cellulose, and those decay and become soil bacteria. But by soil, real differences between those three types of forests. The largest amount of carbon stored in forests is in the tropics. Is in specific tropical forests, but there are vast amounts absorbed in boreal and temperate forests as well. And interestingly enough, in boreal forests, more than half of is soil carbon. When you see good, rich black soil, that's because of the carbon-containing substances in it. And our temperate forests, the old ones, sometimes up to half of the carbon per acre is in the soils. Harvest, a lot of the carbon goes into the atmosphere, and there's a lot of carbon released just in the harvesting process.
Well, on your website, you talk about afforestation and compare it to reforestation and proforestation. Why don't you talk about that?
Okay, well, it turns out that it's estimated that that we have basically removed about half of the trees that were growing to that. Obviously, there's some forests that have been replanted and so on, but there are about half as many. Let me put it this way: there are about half as many trees as there were before we started cutting them down.
Mm.
And so it could be storing twice as much carbon as they are. So when I began to think about this years ago, I'd known for a long time this fact. They measured 48 different forests in the tropics, the boreal forests, and the temperate forests around the world. And what they found was that that's an extraordinary finding, because what it says is, We need to let some trees get big, and we will store more carbon. And of course, instead we wanted to cut the biggest ones down for our industrial purposes. So one of the strategies for addressing climate change, in addition to all of us not using fossil fuels and replacing providing those services with replacements, and we can talk about what those are as well, we could significantly increase forest growth. There's a couple of ways of doing that. We all realize that if we do use wood products, and when we cut down a forest, we should reforest it. And sometimes we just let nature do that. But if it's land owned by a forestry company or is producing far in the future, if it's a natural forest, it's 50 to 100 years before it's cut again. If it's a plantation, if it is cut and then simply replanted like a crop, which you see a lot of that out in the Pacific Northwest, where they plant maybe a whole huge area of Douglas fir, because Douglas fir is a very valuable timber species. In fact, for pulp and paper, they sometimes do it every 15 years. So those forests aren't storing much carbon.
Right.
The trees just aren't big enough.
Right. So younger forests are not nearly as effective as older, larger forests.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. The larger forests, there's some confusion about things, because it turns out for many species, the maximum rate of growth, and so people will say, but those species may live for 200 or 300 years or 400 years, or in the Pacific Northwest with some of the Sitka spruce and things like that, I understand the growth to be 150 years old. They would be storing well more than twice as much as they were storing at half that age.
So proliferation is a philosophy to allow older, larger trees to continue to grow?
Right. We coined the term proforestation because we realized there wasn't a term for it. There's reforestation, which is, you know, replacing a forest that's been cut. There's afforestation, which is sometimes used either more generally or to mean planting trees where they haven't been growing for a long time. But, you know, you'd have to find, I don't think there's enough land to make much of a difference doing it that way.
Oh, I see.
And since these little trees don't really store, mortality of newly planted trees is very high. And so if you go to a place where there are already trees that are 50, 70, or 100 years old, they're already planted. And the important thing is the amount of carbon that's accumulated in the forest, because that's carbon that's not in the atmosphere. I mean, if you think about it, it's either in the atmosphere or it's in the forest. And so the more you have in the forest, that means you have less in the atmosphere. And then the rate of accumulation is certainly important. But to cut down large old trees and plant them with fast-growing young trees,
right,
you're going to have far more carbon in the forest, because cutting big old trees, there's a huge amount of waste that ends up either rotting in the forest, or is sawdust at the mill that gets burned, or is the slab wood that you can't make into lumber that gets burned at the mill. All that goes in the atmosphere right away.
And practices are not particularly effective, is that right?
Well, they're really designed for one purpose, which is to create forest products.
Right.
And if you check with the U.S. Forest Service, they classify forests into three categories. So one category are called reserves. So those would be the forests that are in national parks and places that can't be harvested. They're off limits to harvesting. Then there are something they call other forests, which are forests that just aren't suitable for any timber purposes. So these would be some of the scrub forests.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be 70% of all the forests in the lower 48. So any place that could produce lumber is considered if some portion of it. I'm not saying we should do this with every single piece of forestry, but I'm saying we need to set aside those forest lands that are going to be absorbing the most carbon or accumulating the most carbon in the next few decades.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the time frame we have to get us back to where we were.
Right.
Right. And if we have a tree that's already 70 years old and really growing rapidly, it will continue to grow rapidly for a long time for the most part.
Right.
Right. And we have to act now. And nature has been dealing with that problem for, I think I read somewhere that trees were invented about 400 million years ago. So I think they figured it out.
Right. So you're an advocate for preserving Western forests because Eastern forests are second growth and younger?
Oh, ours, we're about fourth or fifth cutting in parts of the Northeast.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, the soils are being depleted, and you know, they have to have nutrients of various kinds as well as carbon dioxide and water and sunlight. All forests. I mean, actually, our northeastern forests are the least. We practice proforestation and let some of our forests grow. That there are we could increase the carbon storage in many sites between 2.3 and 4 Pacific Northwest and into Montana and so on. Those forests there are still some very big trees there.
Right.
And protecting those that where it's already stored. I mean, why cut and release when you've already got it stored? The work has already been done. and then allow some of the next generation of trees that are, if you look at the biggest trees of all, the sequoias and the giant redwoods, the carbon density per acre of those is just astounding. I mean, it's higher than anything. And the rest of the basically the Pacific Northwest, sort of from Montana west,
Washington
and Oregon.
Right.
That's where we have rainforest in the world. And that would really be useful to keep as a carbon stock.
Well, Bill, I'm afraid we are out of time. I would like to continue this conversation, but we have to cut it off for today. So I really appreciate your willingness to talk about this. Maybe we can do another session. But this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to our website. Just search for Wilderness and Wildlife. Or go to jswilderness5.net or to kgvm.org and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Well, Bill, I'm afraid we'll